First off, if you're listening to this podcast and you've downloaded this podcast, I'm guessing you're not from Vancouver, but we thank you for downloading and listening nonetheless. Elliot Friedman, what happened in Vancouver last night?
Well,
or at least
Elliot Friedman joins us, Hockey Night in Canada, and 31 Thoughts. Pretty quiet day for the Canucks. People were getting upset because there was no draft picks.
I watched that press conference yesterday, and I was like, wow, like that is, like, how's the best way I can put this? P.K. Subban did an interview with Nick Kiprios where he talked about the effect that the media and fans have on the way the Canadians do business. And we've kind of talked about this before. I got to think that the way it's going there in Vancouver, it just seems so edgy and so nasty every day that it just affects the way things get done there. Like Pat Quinn used to always tell us in Toronto, you guys are bad and Vancouver's worse. I really wonder if they're the people who work for the Canucks, and believe me, there's a lot of people who've lived and played there and worked there who love the organization, if they think that it's one of the reasons they've never won. Because, like, I read the coverage every day. As you know, I always make fun of Canucks Twitter. I watch all of your press conferences and stuff. And I got to tell you, at the beginning of the season, everybody looks refreshed. At the end of the season, everybody looks beaten down. And I watched that press conference yesterday, and Benning just looked like he couldn't wait to get out of there. And I listened to Lyndon on radio yesterday, and he was just like, you could tell. He was like a boxer in the corner getting pounded. And, I mean, some markets are worse than others, and it is bad there right now. Like, I do wonder about the toll it takes on people, and if people just sit there and say, I want no part of this.
Okay, so the tweets and the comments afterwards.
Well, I got to tell you, I was astonished at the reaction because it's really nothing I haven't said before about Vancouver.
That's on the Walker Show, by the way, Sportsnet 650.
Yeah, Walker and Rintoul. And I was surprised at the reaction. I mean, you know, one thing, Jeff, I don't believe in fighting with people on Twitter. I believe you say what you say and then you let people have their say. And some people really let me have it, and some people agreed. But there were a few gratuitous shots for the people who let me have it, but mostly they were really good. Yeah, I mean, I have to tell you, I was surprised at how much of a life it took on itself. You know, one person who lives out there, he told me that, you know, what you don't realize living in Toronto is that there's a real battle now between, you know, there's competing radio stations. Mm-hmm. There's our station out there, Sportsnet, and there's the other, you know, telecom competitor. And right now it's kind of positioned as the other guys are the tough guys and we're the apologists. So they really felt that there's something to that, that they feel that if someone from Rogers goes on the radio station out there and defends the Canucks, it's because since we're the rights holder, we have to and we are pressured to, which is nonsense. I fielded the calls before from Canucks management on one case ownership. I do think, and I will stand by 100%, is that the toughest market in the NHL is Montreal. They're first and they're foremost, and there's nobody even close to them.
Common wisdom would say Toronto.
No. You know, I got to tell you, Toronto, I really think, Jeff, there's two things. Number one, Toronto, the issue is volume. But I think Toronto, we're more homers than other cities. I do. You know, we have, like, Bob McCowan is a guy, and Damian Cox, who works for us, and Steve Simmons. Those guys are contrarians who like to do that to set the tone, and they do it very successfully. But I generally think the Toronto media is more cheerleader-y than others.
Okay.
Vancouver's got an edge to it. I think it's the second toughest market in the NHL. There's social media, and it's not just media or just fans. It's the combination of everything. Their social media has got the nastiest edge to it than any other city in the NHL, and it's not close. And I think their media is tough. Like, I have no problem with the media asking tough questions. Like, Pat Quinn always used to say to us that you guys are bad in Toronto, but they're worse. And I think that's just the way it is.
Where does that come from?
I don't know. Like, I don't live there. I don't know. But a lot of guys tell me who play there, work there, that it's always edgier there than anywhere else.
Now, I have this sort of loose theory
that
when it comes to the Vancouver Canucks, and this goes right back to 1967 expansion when they were kept out, and a lot of that was quite simply Montreal and Toronto don't want to divide up the Hockey Night in Canada revenue. Thank you very much. Whether it was losing the draft in 1970 when they thought they'd won, and that's the difference between Gilbert Perreault and Dale Talon. You know, right up to the statue you see outside the arena, which is iconic, and we all recognize what it is. It's Roger Nilsson waving the white flag, which is, you know, the underlying message is we're getting screwed, right? And that's what you see when you go to the arena. That is that one flashpoint moment in Vancouver's history that they want to capture with that iconic stance of Roger Nilsson, that series against Chicago, we're getting screwed here. With the white towel. That is the metaphor you see when you go to see Vancouver Canucks hockey.
Well, I think that's true.
Are they editorially positioned like that?
Yes, I think there is that. And I think also 2011, like that was a very painful loss. You know, one of the people I get along best in the business with is Lawrence Gilman. Mm-hmm. And one of the players I respect the most is Kevin Bieksa. And I remember the next season, for the 2011-12 season, Bieksa did an interview with Hockey Night in Canada where he said he was never going to get over that. And, you know, it's been 7 years, and Lawrence, who I still keep in touch with and was on our podcast last week, he's never gotten over that. And I understand. And I understand the way that Canucks fans feel. You know, I was talking to a couple of GMs yesterday, and I know one, he saw what was happening online last night on Twitter, and he went to go watch the Benning presser. And he watched the Botterill one, too, because Botterill got it in Buffalo.
Yeah, he did.
And he said that it was really wild watching those. And he said the difference is that Botterill fired back and Benning just looked beaten up. And, you know, again, I have no problem with people asking very tough but very fair questions. And I think a lot of those questions were very tough but very fair. But I do think that overall the edge on that market is greater than anywhere else except Montreal. And I do think it takes its toll on the people who work there and play there, because they've all told me it does.
It's funny because, you know, you mentioned Montreal, and there's always been that.
But I would like to say I don't think it's their fault that they haven't won. But I do wonder if it's a contributing factor to all of it, because people either get worn down by it, it affects their decision making, or they don't want to be part of it.
There's only so many times you can be Charlie Brown to Lucy with the football. I mean, you look at how many times the Vancouver Canucks have come close. I mean, there's only so many times you can get there and be close. I know they're blown out by the Islanders, close against the New York Rangers, close against the Boston Bruins. And so finally you have that us against the world. And that 2011 team certainly felt that way. You know, Montreal.
Well, people did call them divers and dirty players.
There were a lot of players on the team, whether it was Burroughs, whether it was.
I thought that
Axel
team played
Pierre.
Hard.
They did play
they
hard.
They play hard. You know what?
I got no problem with that.
I'm 100% with you. I never had an issue with that team.
You know, you look at Montreal, and they come from the most distinct culture of any team in the NHL. You would think they would be positioned as us versus everybody, but it's not. It's Vancouver. If you go around the NHL, they have that other side of the mountain. It's us against everybody in the NHL.
Yes.
I don't know where it started. I have my own little nickel and dime theory that I laid out for you, but it is there.
Oh, it absolutely is there. It's there. Absolutely it's there. And, you know, like, their fans are tougher and more skeptical, even at success, than other cities are. It's nothing I really haven't said before. I always joke about angry Canucks Twitter. I was shocked at the reaction. I didn't think it was going to get the legs it did.
All right, let's get to it then. Welcome to the 31 Thoughts podcast, brought to you by the all-new 2018 GMC Terrain.
Thoughts podcast. You know what I think about when I think about that? This must be the best podcast ever hosted by a former gravedigger who buried the Leafs owner Harold Ballard and a 5-6 year veteran of the Toronto Raptors basketball beat. Look where you guys have come, Jeff and Elliot. Keep it up.
All right, there you go, the voice of Chris Johnston.
That's pretty good. I like that, Siege.
It's pretty good. No matter what I do, by the way, in hockey media, my claim to fame will always be throwing the dirt on the coffin of Harold Ballard.
We've got to tell that story now.
Do we have time for that? I mean, I can do the nickel and dime.
You, you can't not tell the story after Christmas.
I've told it so many times. First day on the job, I just finished my first year of university at Guelph. First day on the job at Park Lawn Cemetery in the west end of the city of Toronto. And it was a busy day. I think they had seven graves to dig. There was only one backhoe, and so they couldn't use that to fill in the coffin for Harold. So they essentially said to me and a couple other guys, here's the shovels, put the dirt on the coffin. It was up in section AA, right at the corner of Prince Edward and Bloor. And very few people have ever had this feeling or phenomenon happen to them, actually being the final punctuation in someone's life. It's a really bizarre, and I still don't know how to describe it, even though I did it numerous times afterwards. I can't really describe the feeling of throwing dirt on someone's coffin, essentially the final moment of them on the earth. But it was Harold Ballard, and that was my first day on the job. And I remember saying to myself in a cynical fashion, in the city of Toronto, everybody complained about him, but only one person did something about it. And that is my one claim to fame. In hockey, that's it, Elliot. I'm never going to. That's a big time claim. Never going to do anything better. I peaked early. I peaked before I started, actually. I peaked before I started. I was still trying to educate myself out of a job at the University of Guelph at that point. Mm-hmm. Coming up on the podcast today, Jeff Jackson is going to be here. Jeff Jackson is a former NHLer. He's a former NHL assistant general manager. He did some work with the NHL early in his law career. He is now an agent with Orr Group. And represents, amongst other players, Connor McDavid and Eric Ekblad. Those are two contracts that are sort of benchmarks, Elliot, for forwards and defensemen around the NHL. So we'll talk to Jax a little bit later on about how you put these deals together. You know, one of the things we want to do with this podcast is hear voices from people you don't normally hear from and sort of get inside. You know, let's have a look inside the watch to see how this thing works. And in that spirit, Jeff Jackson is going to be aboard a little bit later on. So look forward to talking to Jax in a couple of moments. In the meantime, I want to do a quick, maybe we don't have too much, spend too much time on it, but a quick sort of final gloss of what you saw from trade deadline. We expected Carlson, some did anyhow, didn't happen. Expected Pacioretty, didn't happen. In some ways, trade deadline was more notable vis-a-vis who didn't get dealt than who did.
Yes, I completely agree with that. I have to tell you this. The biggest one surprised me was Paul Stastny. People always ask me, like, what percentage do you really know about what happens, about what's going on? I say 10%. And they say, that's low. And I said, no, no, no. There's a lot of stuff out there. I have no idea what's going on. The Paul Stastny one was the one that came out of left field to me. Huh. And I'll tell you a story about Kevin Cheveldayoff. He really likes the secrecy. He takes a lot of pride in getting things done quietly. So when that one didn't get out beforehand, I knew he would be very proud about it. Because I remember last year at the draft, the expansion draft, remember that day, like all the picks started getting out?
Yeah.
The one pick that didn't get out, I don't think was Winnipeg's. I think it was the last one we found out. And it was Chris Thorburn. So the next day or the day later, whenever the regular draft was, I walked over to the Winnipeg table. And I said, I just wanted you to know that I know it's a real source of pride for you that your pick didn't get out. And he just laughed. He said, you know, we were waiting for it. And, you know, I think it's really hard to keep things a secret, especially in a Canadian market.
Yeah.
So I know how much he tries. It's funny. Like, anytime I can get something on Winnipeg, it's like, I like the byplay with him about how much he likes to keep stuff secret.
I talk to a lot of people in junior hockey, as you all know. I talk to a lot of scouts at the NHL level and a lot of scouts at the junior hockey level. And I had a strong sense that something was happening between – now, I didn't have Stastny or think Stastny for 1 second.
No.
But I knew there was something between St. Louis and Winnipeg because over the weekend I talked to someone who said St. Louis has been inquiring not people – in the Winnipeg organization about this player, but elsewhere about Logan Stanley, who's a first-round draft pick of the Winnipeg Jets. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, okay, there might be something here then, and they might be looking – if they're going this out of the way to talk to these people about Logan Stanley, there might really be something there. So I suspected that there was something going on between the two. No idea it was going to involve – well, it didn't end up involving Stanley, but had no idea there was going to be a Stastny deal. That one was a shocker.
Yeah. Now, other stuff, I mean, just some of the other things that I think I have some handle on. Pacioretty, I heard that teams talking to Bergevin or who heard what Bergevin was talking about said that he made it very clear that he was not going below a certain price. Like, I believe L.A., yes, Toffoli, Velarde, their first-round pick last year, and maybe another pick, and the Kings weren't doing that. I heard he asked Minnesota for Charlie Coyle plus, and the Wild weren't doing that. You know, Florida was in, and Pacioretty wanted to go there, and I suspect that Montreal asked for Trocheck, and there's no way Florida was doing that. Now, Pacioretty, you saw his media, his scrum after they played Philadelphia on Monday night, and he said he met with Bergevin after the deadline. And I have heard that Pacioretty is, who was really frustrated and wanted to go, is now determined to be positive and make this work.
It's no surprise. You know, my name is out there, and you know, I don't know what else you guys want me to say other than I'm ready to go home and get a good night's sleep. It's been a, you know, emotional couple days here, and you know, I'm happy to be still a part of this team, and obviously, you know, moving forward, everyone has to hold themselves accountable for where we're at right now, and I definitely do so. And to my knowledge, I think there's been no finger pointing as to you know, why this year has kind of been the way it is. I think if everyone, you know, involved looks in the mirror and takes full responsibility for where we're at, then we're going to be able to move forward and build off that. And I definitely have that mindset right now. You know, I have three kids, and you know, you always prepare for the worst, and just in case. And actually, my younger Max Jr. went to school today with a Habs jersey on, and I said, you know, we want to pick him up and feel good about walking through the school with that jersey. So, you know, I don't know if people have taken it wrong, my kind of shortness with the media as of late, but I appreciate the people that did respect the fact that I'm a human being and have a family to worry about.
He bought a house in Montreal 2 years ago.
Make this work, like, stay,
yeah,
and sign an extension?
I think he's going to... I don't know if that's going to happen, Jeff. Like, when you get through that, you can say, oh, what the hell, I just got to make the best of it. Or you can say, I'm going to make this work. And I heard he's going into it with a positive frame of mind. Like, that's what his goal is going to be. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's going to happen. Like, you know, like, you have relationships with people, whether you work with them or you live with them. And sometimes when you don't talk, like, you get a warped idea of what everybody else is thinking. I get the sense that whatever that Bergevin-Pacioretty conversation was, it made both guys feel a lot better. And I think Pacioretty is going to go at it with the approach of, I'm going to be here to help solve the problems or be a solution of the problems instead of being a cause or part of the problem. And I don't know if Pacioretty is going to resign there, but I think he's going to go with the attitude of, I'm going to be a solution here.
Same of Erik Karlsson in Ottawa?
You know, I don't know that one as much. I think they all said the right things. I think Ottawa's got a different issue than Montreal, and Ottawa's issue is that the players there believe they can really win. And there's a lot of hard feelings there, I think, still between Karlsson and the owner. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you can sort those out. I think what happened, I heard the Vegas offer, or I shouldn't say the Vegas offer. I don't know if it was the Vegas offer or the Ottawa ask. I heard they were talking two first-rounders, one of Vegas's top prospects, and a conditional pick if they re-sign him.
I would think that Erik Brännström might have been that. If they're looking to replace with a defenseman.
I don't know. Like,
I don't know either. I'm thinking if you're going to try to pick off one of those prospects from last year's draft, Cody Glass, Nick Suzuki, or Erik Brännström, I don't know. I might go with that defenseman.
It makes perfect sense to me. I don't know the answer. I just think that that's kind of what they were discussing, and I believe what fouled up the whole thing was, you know, I feel bad talking about Bobby Ryan. The guy's become like a suitcase.
Yeah.
I think what happened was they were going to take Ryan, and
Vegas was going to take Ryan.
Yeah, Vegas was going to take Ryan, and they felt that that should mean the return was less, and Ottawa just decided not to do it.
Pause on that. If you're Pierre Dorion, don't you have to understand that if you're going to take the Bobby Ryan contract, we're handing you a commodity, which is cap space. So that does have to make the return less than if you're just making an Erik Karlsson deal.
Look, we talked about Vancouver earlier and the worries about that market. You know, I think in Ottawa, they know if they make a bad hockey deal for Erik Karlsson, they're in big trouble. They won't be able to sell tickets.
Is it possible then to make a good hockey deal if you're attaching Bobby Ryan's contract to it? Wisdom would say no.
I would think at the end of the day, I wonder if it becomes separate transactions where you trade Karlsson for a haul, if you can, next year or at the draft, and then you use some of what you get to trade Bobby Ryan.
Somewhere. So you attach one of those picks or one of those prospects to a Bobby Ryan deal to take the contract.
Like, one of the theories I heard is that Vegas might still take Bobby Ryan without Carlson if the package is reasonable enough, if Ottawa gives them a good enough incentive. The other thing I heard after I published the blog today, somebody sent me a text and they said they think that what Vegas was thinking was take Carlson for the rest of this year and then potentially flip him at the draft to recoup what they gave up. So there were a lot of permutations to this.
You know, there is a – and this has happened before, and this happens in junior hockey. Two-part deals that aren't really announced as two-part deals, but they end up being two-part deals. Like – the idea that, okay, you're going to get us on this deal that we're going to make right now, and down the road, we're going to get you on a deal, and it's all going to wash. The example that I'll give here, and I could have brought this up on the last podcast, the Denny Savard deal, right, for Chris Chelios, right? At the last minute, as I was told, Montreal came back to Chicago and said, the owner wants a second-round pick on this. And Chicago said, well, no, we can't. Our owner signed off on it. This thing is done. But tell you what we can do. We'll make another deal down the road. We'll include a second round pick in it, and we'll call it a day. Now, Chicago's general manager and Montreal's general manager never survived to see that trade. So you could make the argument that to this day, Chicago still owes Montreal a second-round draft pick. And if you're a Montreal Canadiens fan, start griping now because Chicago owes you a second.
And they'll have a higher pick this year in the second round. So now's the time you really got to start.
Now's the time you want to cash in on the Denny Savard-Chris Chelios deal.
You know, the other stuff on Carlson, you know, Washington was really interesting. I think after Pittsburgh went and got Brassard, I think Washington talked about adding another D. And basically, Brian McClellan admitted that –
does it pick up two depth defensemen?
Well, no, but I think they were going – they were swinging. Yeah. Like, he basically admitted it to Isabel Hershudian of the Washington Post that they were looking at another D. And they inquired on McDonough, I believe, and they inquired on Carlson. Now, I have no idea how that was going to work, but they were looking. You know, Tampa obviously took the Ranger deal. They weren't willing to do what Ottawa wanted to do. I think Nashville was in there. I think they really thought about – how do we add Carlson? And the other one I heard was...
Where would the room be for Carlson?
Well, I think they probably would have had to deal one of their big four, right?
That's it.
And, you know, I think it was probably discussed. I think San Jose was willing to do both Ryan and Carlson, but I don't think their package would have been as good as Vegas's was. And, you know, someone told me Toronto was fiddling around looking for first-round picks because they could do it. You know, Toronto could do it. And the other two teams I kind of wonder about, because they have the room to do it, though I don't know if they have the ability to do it, were Colorado and New Jersey. But I don't know that they were involved. I just wonder about those teams.
Was there one team, and you know they did make one deal with Ryan Hartman, scored the big game winner against the Winnipeg Jets, but was there one team, because to me it's Chicago, that surprised you with their inactivity? I know Chicago moved Kempney. I know they moved Hartman.
Yeah.
You know, part of me really expected this to be the beginning of some type of teardown.
Anisimov has a no-move clause, and I don't think he was willing to waive it. But at the draft, he loses it July 1st. So he only has partial protection there. I think his time may come there. You know, Hartman got moved because I heard the bidding for him. I mean, obviously, they got a lot.
Yeah.
They got a first-round pick, and they got a really good prospect and another pick. And I think there were a lot of teams in on him. I think Calgary was in on him. I think Winnipeg was in on him. And I'm sure there were a lot more. I think there were a lot of teams going after Hartman, so Bowman was able to do the auction. I'm really curious about, at the end of the season, where Chicago decides to go.
We've talked about the coach before. That one stuns me. The general manager who's delivered three Stanley Cups, that would stun me. Would a blockbuster trade, though,
stun you?
Because it wouldn't. I mean,
they've done them, right? They traded Panarin, they traded Hjalmarsson. They're not afraid to do things.
I'm talking like one of the two pillars.
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, you're probably talking Taves there, right? Because they're not trading Kane.
Because you're not trading Kane.
So, I don't know. Like, first of all, would he want to go? That's number one. And number two, and I do not like questioning Jonathan Taves because I think he's, you know, a hell of a player and he's earned the benefit of the doubt. But are you trading for him now?
Based on the season that he's had.
I mean, I just think like...
If you believe in the breath of fresh air philosophy.
Like, Jonathan Toews could play for me anytime.
Of course.
But, you know, he's
There are players that get, and maybe the obvious example right now is Eric Staal, who may be on the best value contract of any forward around the NHL, $3.5 million. But there are players that do have soft seasons and then still do bounce back. It is the exception, I know, more so than the rule.
If I was Chicago, I would keep Taves one more year. I would take the gamble. I would say, I'm going to bet that this guy is going to bounce back.
So then what do you do in the offseason? Stay the course and say, we're going to try this one more time?
No, I would probably check the market on Saad. Anisimov is one.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, are you moving Duncan Keith? Are you asking him if he wants to go?
Still a value contract.
And he's still a good player. I mean, he's not a scorer like he used to be.
Not the same like he used to be.
He's not a scorer like he used to be, but he's still a defenseman who can play a lot of minutes, and he can move the puck.
People are still looking for D out there.
People are always looking. By the way, I was writing in the notes today, Patrice Bergeron's hurt now, might miss some time.
Yeah.
He was my Hart Trophy guy. If he misses the rest of the season, does the Hart Trophy come down to Taylor Hall and Eric Staal?
Taylor Hall, Eric Staal, and Evgeny Malkin.
Okay.
I mean, Taylor Hall, if you're an Oilers fan, cover your ears. You know, just fast forward.
He's having a phenomenal year.
He's having a monster. I mean, as we record this, it's 22 games with a point, and, you know, he is that engine that's driving the New Jersey Devils right now. There's a lot of great stories in New Jersey with that team making the playoffs. Like, this bounce back has been fantastic for New Jersey. And Taylor Hall's the guy. Like, he's once again turned himself into, what, a top three left winger? In the National Hockey League, going away. Maybe the best left winger, the best left winger this season.
He's got what, points in 22 consecutive games?
22 consecutive games.
He's taking a team that had offensive challenges, and he's put them on his back.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
Very legitimate vote.
Where do you put Claude Giroux in that conversation?
He's there, too.
Kucherov?
Yes, he's still there, too.
MacKinnon, still there for you?
Yes. It's tougher when you don't make the playoffs, though, right?
Hang on. Okay, let's pause on that. Because if you just follow the definition of the Hart Trophy.
We've set a bar here now. I believe the voters have set a bar.
But that's arbitrarily saying, now we're going to add this other definition
to the
trophy.
No. But I believe you have to be consistent. If you look at the way the Norris Trophy has been done the last little while, Carlson, Doughty both didn't win it in years. They didn't make the playoffs. To me, that's not arbitrary. To me, that's setting a standard.
But that is not in the definition. Just because you make the mistake of having a new definition once doesn't mean, well, once we've done it for a couple of seasons, now it's fine. We can just keep on doing it.
Here's my point. I don't read dictionaries.
Here's my
point. I go by what actually happens.
Here's my point. The only point that I would make is if you want to follow the definition of the Hart Trophy, you know, the player adjudged to be the most valuable to his team, look at how much offense.
Hey, Nathan Jeff Jackson, MacKinnon is absolutely worth it.
I was going to say Connor McDavid.
Absolutely.
If you just look at just the definition of the trophy, it's Connor McDavid.
Yes. What do you want me to do? Come on here and badmouth Connor McDavid? I'm not badmouthing.
That was
Connor
agent
McDavid.
Coming on in a couple of seconds. I just find that conversation always.
I believe the voting sets a standard, and the standard has been set that you don't win that award if you don't make the playoffs.
So your guy then is it Taylor Hall?
I mean, my guy's Bergeron.
Right.
You know, my guy. The problem for me is like one of the ways I voted, for example. Calder before is that the year that Landeskog and Ryan Nugent-Hopkins were out and the year Panarin and McDavid were together, I believe when you're a young guy, especially in your first year, I know Panarin was a little bit older, it's a skill to play 82 games. It is a hard league.
Yes.
So the year it was Nugent-Hopkins and Landeskog, I voted for Landeskog because he played a full season and Nugent-Hopkins, I think, missed 20 games. I didn't vote for McDavid. I voted for Panarin. Of course McDavid is the better rookie, but a better player, excuse me, but Panarin played the full season, McDavid didn't. I think that means something. Now, you know, if Bergeron misses 2 weeks, he's probably my MVP. But if he misses the last 5 weeks of the season, it makes it harder for me.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, Bergeron's number one on my list.
Final thought on trade deadline?
Can we not come in the air at 8 in the morning anymore?
Can there just be like a friendly handshake over the fence between us and our competitor to say, you know what, why don't we do this at noon?
I think we should do the show from 2:55 to 4.
That's what all the serious offers come in. That's not going to happen. You mentioned, Elliot, not bad-mouthing Connor McDavid. Yes, because we have his agent coming up in a moment. The all-new 2018 GMC Terrain is the compact SUV thoughtfully designed with you in mind. With features like the Traction Select system to revolutionize how you adapt to the road, a fold flat front passenger seat to give you up to 8 feet of cargo space, and an innovative electronic precision shift system to make shifting easier than ever, the 2018 GMC Terrain is truly mighty like a pro. GMC, we are professional grade. Elliot, I'm trying to think of a gentle way to ask this, and I haven't found it yet, so I'm just going to put it out there. Have you received any pictures on your phone late at night recently, perhaps as recently as last night, and if so, from whom?
This story is going to be a total letdown because you made it sound a lot more interesting than it really is. Yes, on Tuesday night, I was at home. I was writing my 31 Thoughts blog, and I started getting some text messages of Jeff Jackson, the current agent and former NHLer who played with Toronto, the Rangers, in Quebec. And I guess he did it first because Paul Stastny's wearing 25 in Winnipeg.
Yep.
As a homage to Thomas Steen, the father of his good buddy Alex Steen. And Jeff wore number 25 in Quebec, so he started sending pictures of himself wearing 25 and saying, no, this is the real reason. But the funniest thing about it was you would have thought Jeff had so much hair back then.
Good feathers.
It looked like he was wearing two toupees.
Nice lid.
And then he started sending, I guess when he was finished Googling himself and his old hockey cards, he started sending pictures of us. And you can explain the one he sent about you, but the one he sent about me is, so years ago I was invited to give a talk at a class at Western.
Yeah.
It was early in the morning, so I drove to London the night before, and I know a lot of people in London, so we went out and we had a few to drink. And so I got up the next morning, and I looked like death, really. And I was wearing this white shirt, and I gave the talk, and at the end, they're like, can we take a picture of you for our classroom wall? And I'm like, this is a really bad idea, but you can't say no. But, like, what's going to happen here? Of course, the photo ends up on the internet.
Naturally.
And my friends find it, and they're like, what you look like? You look awful in this photo. Like, this is so the funniest thing about that picture is I was still single at the time, and whenever I would go on a blind date, and I also briefly tried some online dating, I would either send that picture to the woman I was going to go out with, or I made that my profile picture. And basically it was, if you can tolerate the way I look here, we're going to be just fine because that's the worst picture of me that exists.
So that was the gatekeeper picture then.
That was the one.
If you get past that one,
it was basically,
you're good.
This is bad. Trust me, I look better than this.
Mine was a picture of me with the Honky Tonk Man. This would have been around 1999. I was doing a wrestling radio show. I was sponsored by a pay-per-view company, and they sent me to an establishment called the Manor in Guelph to interview the Honky Tonk Man, and it was a gentleman's establishment. And I did a said interview in the owner's office. That one lives on the internet, me with the Honky Tonk Man. Celebrity photographer Jeff Jackson joins us now from Aura Group. What are you doing sending these late-night pictures to Elliot Friedman, Jax?
Well, like Elliot said, it started with the Stastny connection because I sat beside Peter in the dressing room my years in Quebec, and Paul and Jan were always around the room, so it was a joke. But then I went down a rabbit hole of old photos and bad hair, and then I found that picture of Elliot, and it sounds like he wasn't surprised that that's the one that I sent you. You've seen that before.
I saw it. I was like, "There's another photo too," and this is really going out there. So, my stepsister, she runs a nutrition company. She's very good. She's very fitness oriented. And they were like, can we take a picture of you and we can put it on our website? And I'm like, no. And like my stepmother was like, really, you know, you could really be doing us a favor if you could do it. And my stepsister Natalie's like, can you do this for me? And basically I was weakened. And so I did it. And now, like, if you Google Elliot Friedman wife, that's the picture of me that's out
there.
That's
the one that shows up.
Yeah.
I saw that one last night.
So there's no point in even explaining this particular one. But those are the two pictures, honestly, Jeff, that get sent to me the most saying, what is the deal with this?
You know, you mentioned playing with Quebec. And the last time I was there was the closing of the Colisée, was Memorial Cup, the final, Oshawa Generals, and the Kelowna Rockets. And so I got to spend 2 weeks staying at a condo just outside of where Chateau Frontenac is, and cobblestone streets and all that, running on the Plains of Abraham. When you think of Quebec City as a hockey player, what comes to your mind right away?
Well, I loved playing there and spent almost 5 years, and the city is beautiful. The fans, they were great, and it was lots of fun for the players. There's fantastic restaurants. It's a small city, but it's very European-esque. So you enjoyed that part of it, and then the wives and girlfriends could ski. Mount St. Anne was close, and
yeah.
I got married in Quebec. I enjoyed my time there. I loved it. I think it would be great to have a team there again. Obviously, there's other factors at play other than just a building and having a good fan base. There's corporate base and all that stuff. So I'd love to see a team back there, and I loved playing there. It was great.
Did you take the time to learn French?
I did. I attempted to. We had access to tutors, and the tutor came to our condo quite a lot and gave us lessons. And my ex-wife went to school there and did a French immersion.
Oh, really?
For a couple of years. So I found it a bit frustrating, though, that when we attempted to speak French, we were learning Parisian French, and it's Quebecois French. So yeah, it was hard because we were trying to practice, and we were practicing Parisian French, and it didn't translate sometimes, and it would just cause a lot of frustration. So hockey-wise, though, it was all in English, obviously.
You know, I remember the first time I went to Montreal, and same deal, like in high school in Ontario, Toronto, you learn that. And I was trying to use the plus que parfait and all the different terms. And someone looked at me and said, look, we just used the simple passé here. Don't try any of that garbage. I can totally understand it.
Every time I'm in Montreal for assignment, I always hear the same thing. How deep is my French going to take me into the city? Like the minute I get off the plane, like that's it. I just try to speak. I took French extended in high school. So I try to see how deep my French will take me into Montreal. I haven't got farther than the cab ride to the hotel before the driver just says, we appreciate the effort, sir. Let's just get on with this transaction. I haven't got it past the cab. I can remember, Jeff, one very specific phone call from you. It was simple. Get in the car, meet me at, I can't remember what the rink was, somewhere in Toronto. You're going to see the future of hockey. And I kind of like rolled my eyes. Okay, Jax, I'm going to go see the future of hockey. And you're taking me to see Connor McDavid play. And he's playing on that loaded Marlboros team with, you know, Josh Hosang and Sam Bennett and Jaden Lindo and Jeremiah Addison, like Roland McEwen, stack team, right? Yep. Remember my first time seeing him. What was your first time seeing someone who's, you know, now your client?
There's a tournament every year at the beginning of the GTHL season. It's the Titan tournament. It's like late August, early September. And he was playing for the minor midget Marlies as a Bantam. And I had been tipped off about this kid from Sam Gagne, who was a friend of mine and a client, and Sam had been in Oakville on the ice working on his game, working on his skills by himself, and this kid shows up in his equipment. He's,
is that the backyard rink?
This was over at one of the rinks in Oakville, and I guess Connor was there on another rink and came and said, can I come on the ice with you, Mr. Gagne? So they went on, and they kind of messed around a bit and passed the puck around, and I got a call from Sam saying, like, Jax, you got to find this kid. This David O'Connor kid who plays for the Marlies, he's doing stuff I can't do, and I've been in the league for 5 years. So I called the Marley organization. I tracked him. They kind of laughed at me. They said, you know, you must meet Connor McDavid. So yeah. I went and I looked at the schedule, and I went to this Titan tournament, and I was with a good friend of mine, Ken Hornick, who scouts for the London Knights now, and watched one shift, and I just kind of turned to Kenny and said, like, wow, like, this kid's unreal. Yeah. Like, this is unreal. And he was smaller then, but you could see it. Any hockey guy that's been around and played, and you guys, you'd watch him one shift, and you'd say, there's something special here.
I remember the first game that you took me to watch him, and I remember this is, you know, Hosang is, you know, grabbing the puck and deking everybody out, circling back just so we can deke them out again. Like, there's that enthusiasm of being a 15-year-old, 14-year-old who's highly skilled, who wants to show off all of his skills. And I remember watching McDavid, and I remember I turned to you and I said, he looks like a pro hockey player. Like, he looks like an NHLer already. He's 14 years old, even back then.
Yeah, because I think his processor's always been that way. Like, he thinks way above everybody else, and he simplifies a game sometimes. And sometimes people say to me now, like, you know, when I watch him away from the puck, he kind of seems like he's floating. But, like, it's all I kind of equated to a GPS. He's got some sort of weird GPS that he's tracking things all the time, and it's like some of the other great players that have played before him. Like, they have their own way of doing it, and he conserves energy really well. Like, and when he needs to go, he's like, you know, it's ready. He's got all the power he needs, but he thinks the game at a whole different level.
So how much can you get into, how do you become his agent? How does that process work?
Well, in my case, it was good fortune because I had started, when I left my job with the Leafs, I took some time off, and then I kind of fell into the agency business a little bit. I was called by some players, and Sam Gagner talked to me, and I started representing a few guys, and I started recruiting players, and Connor was one of the guys that I wanted to recruit. So I met with his dad, Brian, a couple times and had coffee and chatted, and you know, he said, listen, man, your resume is great. You know, you played and you worked in the league and you're a lawyer. But he goes, I really think my kid's going to need an organization and you're really on your own. And I know I tried to make the pitch that I could fill in all the holes around because I had the relationships that I needed to do that with, you know, medical training, nutrition, all that stuff, all the ancillary things, marketing, all that stuff. But they made the decision to go with Bobby Orr's group or hockey group. And then fortuitously for me, Bobby and Rick Curran approached me a few months later and asked if I was interested in joining them. And I took a look at a couple of the kids that they had in their lineup, including Connor and Aaron Ekblad. And the guys that I'd recruited, I said, this is a good opportunity for me, and I'm a good fit with those guys. Our personalities mesh. So that's how I ended up representing Connor. It was kind of through the back door in a way.
Ben Harper, your first client, I think? With Ottawa,
Ben Harper was
who just got a one-way deal.
Yeah, he was my first client. Him and Justin Scott, who plays in Columbus's organization. But Ben was a forward. I was at a game, and he got flipped a D halfway through the game. And I think I told you the story, and I was like, that kid's a defenseman. He's got to play defense. And nobody really saw him as a player. No one was even going to draft him in the OHL. Mike Kelly and Guelph liked him and drafted him pretty early. And Scott Walker and Billy Stewart and those guys in Guelph did a great job developing him into an NHL defenseman.
You know, I know the contracts are all different and the negotiations are all different. But a lot of listeners, and listen, I'm no different, might not understand is how the frameworks of deals start to get put together, how the initial conversations go, who do you deal with, where do you start? At what point does money become a factor? How long do things take? I mean, you've been part of, you know, two benchmark deals of recent note in the NHL. Aaron Ekblad, which in some senses is the modern day contract, the modern day Drew Doughty contract. And then the other one is Connor McDavid, which is a new benchmark for players in the NHL. People just focus on Connor for now. How did that deal start to come together? How much can you share with our listeners, like how things like that evolve and finally get put to bed?
Well, I mean, it's not hard to figure out that for a player like Connor, the Oilers with their new building and all of the building that's going on around, and they wanted a commitment long term for Connor. And you know, if he plays out his 7 years and he's free at 25, so it wasn't brain surgery to figure out that they were going to come and talk to us early. And we'd gone through the same process with Aaron the year before in Florida. But the Oilers, you know, I have a good relationship with both Peter and with Bob Nicholson. And when I go to see Connor in Edmonton, I usually stop by and see those guys and chat. And one of the times I was there, I was like, you know, I'd like to start talking about Connor. And I'd already started to put some thought into what that might look like. And so we just had conversations over a course of a few months, and then as we got through the season and got to the draft, and we started to talk in more concrete terms. And it was very similar in some ways at that point to every other negotiation. The team will give you an offer, a written offer.
They put down the number first?
They put the offer down.
Okay.
Probably in 98% of cases. And you work off of that. And Peter was very realistic, and there was kind of no like silly posturing on either side about, you know, let's go low and let's go high. And we both kind of knew, I think, where it was going to end up in the general vicinity of where it was going to end up. But there's also a lot of factors that are surrounding. The cap system puts a lot of pressure on both the teams and the players, especially players like the star players.
You bring that up. So it got reported by somebody who might be in this room that McDavid's contract initially was going to be 13.25, and it came down to 12.5. And it was believed, Jeff, that initially some of the reaction – and look, I think Connor McDavid is worth every penny he wants. But it came down, Jeff, initially that he was concerned about the reaction that he was taking too much. How did you go from where it got reported to where it eventually ended up?
Well, as I've told kind of everybody who's asked that, it never really was done. It was getting close to being done. And Connor's decision at the end of the day had really nothing to do with public pressure. It was more his own internal gauge of where he needed to be in the team structure, the cap structure. Like, we went through cap projections, how much the cap was going to grow over the next few years, his percentage of that, and how that was going to decrease as the cap went up and all that. But, you know, if you know Connor McDavid, his he's a team first guy, and he was concerned about being able to put a team around him, and he was concerned about teammates. And it's unlike a lot of other sports where I've had agents in other sports tell me, oh, these guys just take as much as they can get. And where the chips fall, they fall with the teammates. I think hockey guys in general, and Connor's no different, they care about what their teammates think. And, you know, on the agent side, I'm trying to position it so that he understands that this is a business, and it's a, you know, you have a limited time to make your money, and it'll all work out. Like, here's what happened with Sid back, you know, when he signed his first extension and his percentage of cap, and here's where you're at, and here's what it'll be in 2-3 years. Here's what it'll be in 6 years when the cap, you know, if you take a very conservative approach to cap growth, you're going to have a way smaller percentage of the cap than you start with, you know, in 2019. Mm-hmm. So, but at the end of the day, it was Connor's decision that he felt comfortable at the number that we ended up with, and that's what we did.
When you're negotiating now, whether it's Connor deal, whether it's the Ekblad deal previous, how important for your clients right now, perhaps much to the chagrin of the NHL, likely so, is the idea of lockout insurance. Guaranteed money for the player should there be another lockout. How crucial is that from your point of view? And how willing are teams to budge on it? I mean, clearly with a couple of your high-profile guys, but in general, how easily do they budge off if at all?
It's like every other negotiation. It depends on your leverage. So it depends on the player. It depends on the number. In those two instances, I think that I probably had as much leverage to get the structure that I wanted. There's other situations where, you know, you're signing a player to a really good deal for him, but the team doesn't even want to talk about structure and signing bonus. Like, these were unique circumstances, particularly with Connor, probably even more so than Aaron. But, I mean, it's a process. It's like evolving. I think Connor's is the first deal that's gone from entry level to the point that he's at, and that's changing the thought process in the league. The 5-year deals, those bridge deals that were kind of halfway.
Yeah.
There's still going to be some of those, but like the Austin Matthews and the top guys they're jumping now.
It's going to be 2 and it's going to be 8. That kind of a thing.
I think so. But you'll see other deals. But, I mean, there was a time where it was 5 years, right? Those second deals were always 5 years.
You know, when you did the Ekblad deal, the draft was in Buffalo. Even though it wasn't signed for another 5 or 6 days, that broke when we were all at the draft. And I remember that got reported, and an agent stopped me in the hallway of a Buffalo hotel, and he said, I saw that. Are you sure? And I go, yeah, I think that one's going to happen. And it was 8 years, $7.5 million. And then I realized why he was asking me. He had another restricted defenseman who was in the process of negotiating a contract. And he was like, I want to make sure that you are right about this. And I said, I believe I'm right. It's going to happen. And he said, okay, that's good to know. Mm-hmm. And then I found out later that when it got out, the team that this agent was negotiating with called Florida right away and said, is this true? We have to know if this is true right now. And so I wonder, when you're negotiating, how much contact or feedback, whether positive or negative, do you get from other agents about the deals that you do?
Well, during the negotiation, I don't talk to anybody else.
And I
don't talk to the media as little as possible. Not because I don't, I mean, I respect you guys, but you guys find out information. I don't know how you do it, but you find out everything because you're good at your jobs. But I try to just keep it really tight. Do my research, you know, on McDavid and Ekblad. It's like kind of months of sitting around looking at all kinds of charts and comparables and analytics and looking at, you know, the business of hockey and cap growth and all that stuff.
Yep.
You know, so I'm comfortable when I'm in a negotiation that I have my that I'm prepared, and so I don't consult with anybody else.
I guess what I'm more wondering is, when it gets done, do you have other agents say, good job, or...
You made my client richer, thanks.
Or, you know, you really hurt my guy because he's in the same situation, I want him to make more. Do you get that?
No, I don't get a lot of it either way. I mean, some guys would that, you know, you've known in the business a long time will say, you know, that's a great deal. But I don't get anybody saying, and it's not that they don't think it, but I don't have anybody saying, oh, that deal really killed me. I think in the league side of it, it was more when I worked for the team.
Oh yeah,
we were more prone to calling up other teams and saying, "What are you
doing? What are you doing? You
know, really?
That's legendary.
Can you give us
that's
an example without saying who or what? But can you give us an idea of a conversation?
Oh, I probably can off the top of my head, Elliot. But I know that it happened when we had guys call us and say, "Why'd you do that?" And it's always unique to the circumstance, and it's not always straight up money. There's other considerations, and it's the same on the player side.
If there was, I mean, you mentioned, you know, everything is sort of all under this, you know, umbrella of the CBA, and some people made the point that perhaps the art of the general manager now is, you know, not as profound as it used to be when it was, you know, Sam Pollock and it was Bill Torrey, you know, and making deals and running an organization, because as you mentioned, you come in, you triple salary cap, there's a 20%, there's a individual rookie cap, there's all these different cap systems within the system itself. But from a wide point of view, if there was something that Jeff Jackson could change about the CBA, are there one or two things that really, really bite on you? Is there anything that you could just wave the magic wand? Of course, salary cap sticking, so that one's a given. Is there anything that we might be missing that you could say to yourself, man, I really wish this wasn't part of the CBA?
There's a lot of things, actually. But, you know, if I could choose anything, I think that obviously, everybody that sits in my chair on the agent side and the player side would say that they don't love escrow, but it's a function of balancing the system. So it's a necessary evil.
You need escrow. The minute you sign off on linkage, that's kind of a reality.
You have to have some mechanism there. So I don't like having gone through Connor's negotiation. I don't like having a limit on individual salaries. I think if you've got a cap of $70 million, like the team, why put a limit on a star player?
So the 20%.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, people come to watch the star players. I would say that with players like Connor McDavid and Sidney Crosby, and that's what people come to watch. So, you know, they're the drivers. So why limit them? And I don't like the fact that you can't renegotiate deals. Like, mistakes get made all the time, and GMs get roasted for making mistakes, and they got to bury money. But the money stays in the system, and it ends up affecting the players. I'd like to be, if you made a mistake, you can renegotiate. Now, I don't know how you do that, but I don't like the system now where it's like if you do a deal, you're locked in, and the only way out of it is buying your way out.
The only way out of it is a lockout, and then you get the amnesty buyout. That's about the only way you get out of it now, but you got to go through the pain of a lockout.
Yeah, and that's no fun.
Do you tell your clients to put away money or anything like that for those upcoming years?
Well, specifically, I don't tell them to do that, but I've only gone through one lockout as an agent. At that time, I only had Sam Gagne as a client. His dad, Dave, is a very astute businessman, so I'm sure he told Sam, but the PA does a good job educating the guys and talking to them about strategic things like that. It's not hard to see what's going a few months out, so if I was a young player, I'd be trying to save all my money all the time anyway, so it wouldn't change because there might be a lockout.
You do have the reputation of not, you know, going to your wallet very much. No, by the way.
You just pulled that out of your hat. I can see that your face light up there.
You mentioned Sam Gagne, and that was an interesting situation with the Columbus contract. And, you know, good on Sam, good on your agency for doing it the way you did, because it was almost like, okay, here he is. You know, established NHLer who's taking a step back contract-wise to take two steps forward a year afterwards. Taking a show-me contract where Sam was at, What were some of the risks that you guys took into account? What were some of the conversations with Sam about that Columbus deal, which, you know, that got parlayed into a nice Vancouver contract? What were those conversations like with Sam?
Well, I think Sam was he'd been a 9-year pro at that point and had only played in the minors his very last year with Philly. Philly sent him down for 3 weeks in January. So his thinking had changed a little bit because he'd had a rough year. He'd played pretty well in Philly when he came back up and finished strong. They played in the playoffs. So he was feeling good about his game, but he'd also kind of, he'd gone through that difficulty of being a first-time AHL player. And I think it just changed his perspective a little bit on stuff. And when we looked at opportunities that he had that summer, the best opportunity was Columbus. And to their credit, you know, we got on the phone with Yarmo and Bill Zito and Basil McRae and John Tortorella and John Davidson and had a call, and they told him, here's how we're going to use you. This is how we'll play to your strength. Tortorella got on the phone, John did, and told Sam, and they had subsequent conversations about it. But exactly what they said they would do, mm-hmm. from an opportunity point of view, they did.
So that was, here's your spot in the
you're going to play on the power play.
You're
going to get opportunity to play to your strengths, play on the power play. You'll play up and down the lineup. You'll play wing. You'll play center. You may play on the fourth line some nights or most nights, but you're going to play on the first power play. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened, and Sam performed. And sometimes for players, it's good to know what your role is, game in and game out, and then you just play within yourself and you really, you know, you're focused. And it really worked really well for Sam in Columbus. So the risk, I don't know what the risk was. I thought he would have a good year because he was going to get opportunity to play to his strengths because he's got lots of skill.
I think it was last week, Elliot, maybe the week before, we talked about second chance people around the NHL. And we came to the name John Ferguson, and you work with John in Toronto. What do people, or what did people not understand about John Ferguson that you, who worked with him closely, did and do?
Well, he came into a really brutal situation in Toronto as a young guy, really.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And John and I had developed a relationship working at the NHL office in New York when we were both law school students. So we were both interns a couple summers, so we got to know each other and hung out a bit. And he went to St. Louis. And when he got the job, and we kept in touch and talked periodically, we got the job in Toronto. I just said to him, you know, having been around the city, like, it's going to be tough. The media is going to be very difficult no matter what. So just be prepared for it. But the thing that, to answer your question, the thing about John is he's got a great sense of humor. Everybody thought he was ultra serious. And
well, he always came across that way.
Well, he was guarded because I'm sure I'm not the only one who called him and said, be careful what you say in the media because they'll come back and bite you. So he was very guarded.
Well, you know what happened, Jeff? You might remember. And you know what? I think John, when he gets his second chance, I think what happened in Toronto will help him a great deal. But his first day on the job, remember Doug Gilmore had played, I guess, the one shift. And he got injured in Calgary. And so his first day on the job, somebody asked him, what about Gilmore for next year? And John said, I don't think he's going to be in our plans. And that was the headline, like Ferguson, Gilmore out, like kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think after that day, he was...
The guard went up.
So guarded.
Well, he's an extremely bright hockey guy. He knows players. He knows the league inside and out. He's like an astute judge of talent in my mind because I worked with him. And we'd go through players and I don't think he was wrong too often on players. So I think, I'm hoping that Ferg gets an opportunity somewhere else to run a team because, like you said, I think in a different spot, a different time, he'll do a really good job.
He's done a great job with Boston.
He did a great job in San Jose, too. He was with those guys for 5 years and probably had a lot to do with the success they had over those years.
I wanted to ask you, I always like to ask about recruiting stories, recruiting players and stuff like that. When Stu Jackson was the head coach of the Vancouver Grizzlies, he used to be in college, or he was the GM of the Grizzlies. He was in college at Wisconsin years earlier, and I asked him, what was it like to recruit players? And he said, the best story I can tell you, it didn't happen to me, but it happened to one of my rivals. They went to meet a player, and they really liked the player. They really wanted to get him. And they said, oh, boy, we had a great meeting. They were walking out to their car, and they were so excited. They said, we're going to get this guy. And as they backed up, they ran over the family dog.
Oh,
he goes,
thanks.
So I'm wondering, of all your like player recruiting stories, what's the one that stands out?
Yeah, we haven't killed any animals yet. Man. I don't know. I mean, we take a pretty practical approach to our recruiting, and we don't recruit a lot of players. And we, Dave and I try to identify with the help of, you know, like we've got a couple young guys, Brock Willett and Alex Eaton, who work for us, and we rely on people that we know in the business and scouts and different things to give us heads up, people we know, like young kids. And we just go have a practical conversation with them. We don't really pitch them.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we feel like our experiences in hockey speak for themselves. So it's usually a fit personality-wise. That's what I find. You get a feeling sitting down with a family and a player pretty quickly whether there's like a connection.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, it's worked out pretty good. And, you know, we haven't gotten all the players we've tried to recruit, but we've gotten some of the guys that we really wanted. But I don't have any stories where we thought we were getting a guy and then we totally got blown away.
How are the parents? Are they better or worse than they used to be?
I think parents are always, they always care about their kids. So they always have I don't want to say a skewed view of their kids, but they care about them so much that they want the best for them. And sometimes what we bring as advisors and agents is just some practicality to the situation, especially when they're really young. Like we try to filter out what's not important. Like you don't get caught up in this, don't get caught up in that, because that's not what's important. And enjoy the process. That's Dave's Gagne's mantra to the parents. Like, because he went through it with Sam.
Sure.
And you have to enjoy the kid's successes and not get wound up and worrying about what's like coming down the pipe in 6 months or a year all the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've got a couple of kids up for the draft. I mean, Evan Bouchard has been, you know, exceptional. Alan McShane with Oshawa. Kevin Ball of the Ottawa 67s. But kids that are younger than that. I think of Quentin Byfield and Jamie Drysdale. How do you keep them and their parents away from the craziness that can be hockey? Like, how do you protect kids that are that young? I mean, the NHL draft is one thing. The OHL draft is another creature altogether. And Quentin Byfield, you know, this year, the beginning of the season was lighting things up, and people are comparisons to Eric Lindros and all that, and you watch Drysdale skate, and you think, holy smokes, this kid is fantastic. How do you protect them as an agent?
Well, in those instances, and we're very fortunate that they have – both boys have great parents. They don't have any unreal expectations, and they're stressed, but not to the point where it's all-consuming and they're going off track. They're concerned about their boys and where they're going to end up. Probably more worried about moving away from home next year to play in the OHL or play or go to the NCAA in a couple years or whatever. That's what they're worried about. But I don't know. In a Byfield's case, there was lots of hype early in the year because he's a very good player, and there was lots of media outlets wanting to do stories. And we tried to protect him by just saying, no, like, he's playing minor midget. Let him have fun with his buddies and enjoy the year, and let's talk at the end of the year if there's a story to be done about the kid.
Could be disruptive to the team.
Because all of these kids in minor midget, this is kind of, they all think it's their make or break year, which is not really true, but they all believe that. And it shouldn't be about one player on these teams. They're all 15-year-old kids, 16-year-old kids. And so that's one way with Quentin in particular, where we just kind of, we deferred talking to media until a little bit later.
Do you feel you have been sufficiently grilled?
Yes, I do.
Be going right home, or will you be out to scout tonight?
I got to go to London with Dave Gagne to watch a young kid play. I haven't seen him play yet. He's apparently pretty good, so going down to London tonight.
How bad is the coffee at GTHL rinks on a scale of 1 to 10?
I don't know. I've never had one. I always bring a cup with me at Starbucks or something. I'll drink tea at the rinks because I know there's, you know, you can't go wrong with a bag of tea.
Nice touch. Thanks, Jack. It's always a pleasure.
Okay. Thanks.
Sportsnet.ca, your online home for everything sports. Dunks, dives, and deeks. Catch highlights, news, and the best storytelling in Canada. Featuring all the stories you want to read in one place. Plus, exclusive podcasts including 31 Thoughts and At the Letters. Canada's deepest roster of storytellers. Sportsnet.ca, your online home for everything sports.
You know, Elliot, we have in hockey literature books written by hockey players, by hockey coaches, by general managers, by broadcasters, like almost every single level of and layer of the game, there is literature written by people that are involved in it, but not so much on the agent side.
Yep.
And we haven't had, you know, the book of, you know, pick your lockout, you know, 2005, 1995, you know, the last 2012. We haven't had those books written from the agent's point of view. I know they can kind of get a bad reputation. I mean, they are in it to represent a very singular focus. I'm trying to maximize value here for my client. That is my job. But are their voices as understood as maybe they should be?
You know, I would advise you, Jeff, to buy a book called The Bald Truth. Now, David Falk was a very powerful NBA agent in the 1980s and early 90s. He had Patrick Ewing. He had James Worthy. He had Michael Jordan. As Chris Johnston mentioned in his promo there, I used to be a basketball reporter.
Yes.
And I remember when David Falk showed up at a Raptors game and he walked into the dressing room to meet Damon Stoudemire. And everybody stopped and watched because this was the power agent introducing himself to the Raptors' first franchise player.
Yep.
So he wrote a book called The Bald Truth. And you know how we think on the outside, we think about how, well, if you're an agent and you're trying to negotiate a contract for Austin Matthews, that's the easy contract. But what if you're trying to do a contract for, say, Max Pacioretty? You say, okay, well, Max Pacioretty scored 30 goals last season, and this guy who scored 30 is getting paid $6 million, and this guy who scored 30 is getting 6.1, so that's where Pacioretty fits. So we all think that that's where it goes, right? Mm. He was the guy who first showed me a real, true, in-depth idea on how agents think. And he had Patrick Ewing. And the Knicks win the lottery, and everybody's all excited. And they say, okay, this is what we're going to pay him. He's like, no, you're going to pay him this. And I can't remember, I don't, but it may have been a record for an NBA player at the time, but it was a huge number. It was not in the rookie salary structure. And the Knicks were like, we're not going to do that. Like, this guy makes this, this guy. And he said, No. I'm talking about what Patrick Ewing is worth to you, not compared to those guys. And that's the way it was fine. Like, he told a story about James Worthy wanting to do individual deals. And somebody says, oh, you want to turn him into a tennis player having his own thing? And he goes, yeah, that's exactly what I want to do. And that was 1982. He talked about James Jordan, Michael's late father, going with Michael and David to their first meeting. And James Jordan saying, don't you have any new ideas? And basically, I would advise you to read that book. And anybody's out there who's interested in the way agents think, I would advise you to go read a book called The Bald Truth. Because when Falk had the big clients, and he was the big cheese among NBA agents for a decade at least, how he wielded the power and how he drove up the salaries at the beginning, that is what you have to understand.
I can recall, you know, speaking of individual contracts, for players outside of hockey, I'm immediately, as you say that, Elliot, I'm immediately taken back to, I think the agent was Rich Winter. It's when Grant Fuhr was in St. Louis, and he had the deal with Pepsi. And the deal was Grant Fuhr's pads were going to be painted as Pepsi cans. And the NHL shut it down. I remember it was greeted, like, hockey is notoriously conservative. I mean, this was greeted with frowns from every corner. And I thought to myself, man, this is pretty cool. Like, here's a guy who is maximizing value, and, you know, I'm sure it's an advertisement for a cola company, but still, like, it's that outside-the-box thinking from that agent for that client. Do we think we ever get there?
Well, you never know. Like,
that was a bold one, and that was, like, 95.
It's probably going to be 20 years, right? Like, I mean, who knows where we're going to be in 10, 15, 20 years. But, you know, the NBA has done the small patch on the jersey now, and teams can sell them individually. The NHL has them on their practice jerseys. But, you know, there were teams that really fought back about the ad on the jersey. Brian Burke, when he was GM of the Leafs, was absolutely against it. Mm-hmm. I heard the Montreal Canadiens were against it. But eventually, it's going to happen because people want to see growth. People want to make more money. We're going to get there eventually. I just don't know how it's going to all work. I don't know if we'll ever have Pepsi on the
We look pretty cool. You got to admit.
I would laugh my head off the first time, and then I'd be, you know what? Maybe what they do is they let them do it in practice or something.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if I want to see that in a game, but if you want to let Carey Price wear it for fun one day in practice, why not?
Why not? And speaking of netminders, I want to talk to you about Roberto Luongo.
I just want to start off by saying that I live in Parkland. I've been living there for the last 12 years. My wife was born and raised in that area. My kids go to school in Parkland. When I'm done playing hockey, I want to spend the rest of my life in Parkland. I love that city. Last week, it was Valentine's Day. I was in Vancouver. And obviously, we all know what happened, and it was hard for me to be on the West Coast and not be able to get back home and protect my family. So no child should ever have to go through that. It's terrible. It's time for us as a community to take action. It's enough. Enough is enough. We got to take action. To the families of the victims, our hearts are broken for you guys. There's not much to say. It's heartbreaking. You guys are in our thoughts. We've been thinking about you every day, constantly, for the last week. And just know that we're there for you. If you guys need anything, you'll be in our prayers. And let's try to move on together. Just to the teachers at the school, you guys are heroes. Protecting your children. Some of them didn't make it trying to protect children. And that is truly what a hero is. And those people need to be put on a pedestal for the rest of their lives. The last thing I want to say is, since last Wednesday, I've been watching the news, and I've been seeing what the kids from Douglas Stoneman doing. And I am very, very proud of you guys. You guys are brave. You guys are an inspiration to all of us. And at the end of the day, you guys are what's giving us hope for the future. Thank you.
Roberto Luongo speaking last week. First game back, Florida Panthers at home after the Stoneman Douglas high school shooting tragedy. Wonderful speech by Luongo. You know, when he started thanking teachers, you know, that was the moment that cynical Jeff Merrick kind of got choked up and pulled back a little bit. That was the moment where, bang, he's just, you know, personalized it for parents in talking to teachers. That was a spectacular moment. And when he started to thank the kids and sort of hinted at activism of some of the kids and who have gone on to confront the NRA and to do something about gun laws, not just in the state of Florida, but in the entire United States, I couldn't help but thinking to myself, A, wonderful for those kids, horrible that I had to go through that to get there.
Mm-hmm.
But I started to think about hockey player activists, and mm-hmm. we don't have many.
Nope.
At all. I mean, there was Tim Thomas, who refused to go to the White House with Barack Obama and put up a Facebook post about it and said, that's my explanation and I'm not taking questions,
mm-hmm.
which to me was sort of a cop-out. You can't just say, hey, check me out on Facebook for everything you want to know about me and Barack Obama. Like, if you're going to make that stance, like, stand up and answer questions for it. That was a distinction that I would make, much like if you're any sort of, you know, athlete activist, you know, stand up and, you know, be accountable and make your case and dig in your heels and stand by it. We don't have that in hockey.
Mm-hmm.
Like that.
You know, JT Brown.
JT Brown was one with Tampa. Yep. Absolutely. That was one. Mm-hmm. A couple of players were asked. Joel Ward certainly was asked about taking a knee during the anthem.
Well, Chris Stewart came to the aid of PK Subban when a former player made a really moronic comment a couple of weeks ago. Stewart came to Subban's aid. You know, Devontae Smith-Pelly has been through something really rough recently, that incident in Chicago, and he was public about it, which I completely agree with. You know, I have to tell you, like, I think hockey's changing. We've talked about this before. I think the next generation will change the sport. Jeff talked about how hockey players generally don't rock the boat. How other agents told him it's very different. I think what Roberto Luongo and Derek Englund earlier this year are proof of is that there is a will. I think they just prefer not to do it. I think it's the nature of the sport. And, you know, I wrestle with this all the time. You know, there are things I tweet about autism and things like that. There's things I don't tweet about that make me angry, and I wonder about tweeting about it or saying things about it. You know, when I was younger and I was first starting out, I'll tell you a story about Damian Cox. I covered a Maple Leaf preseason game, and they fell down behind 4-0 to Montreal in like 10 minutes, and the crowd was booing, and it was crazy. And the next day, Damian wrote a column about Jeff Ware.
The defenseman, yeah.
He didn't write a column ripping them. And I said, I thought you were going to rip them after our conversation in the press box last night. And he, you know, I'm sorry to use the phrase, especially now, save your bullets, but that's the term he used. And he always said that it was more effective when you didn't do the same thing over and over again. And I believe that for myself. Just personally, there's the autism situation in most of Canada, British Columbia is an exception, is something that really bothers me.
Of course.
But I believe if you constantly do it, people ignore it. And I think there are certain things you have to have a voice on, but I always weigh myself between when is it too much and when do you do it? I don't understand right now how you could blame someone in the United States who was a black person for feeling angry about the way the U.S. is right now. I don't understand how you could feel angry about that. So I think when I see LeBron James constantly commenting, I don't fault him. I think this is a time in the U.S. where you have to if you feel that way. But I always do weigh it in terms of for my own activism and things I think that are important. I don't want people ever to look at me and say, oh, he's droning on about that again.
Yep.
So I really think it's important to do it when you really think it can make a difference. That's just me, and I suspect that hockey players probably think similarly to I do.
You think, for me, when I hear one specific word, it's the shutdown word, and you hear it in hockey. I can't speak to other sports like you can, but you can either back this up with other sports or deny it or shoot it down. There's one very specific word and phrase that when I hear it, it makes my skin crawl. And I think it shuts down any idea of being anything other than a hockey player for hockey players. Shut up and skate, dummy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the word is distraction. When I hear, it's always when someone steps outside of the boundaries of what a hockey player should do, what's the first thing we hear? Oh, he's become a distraction to the team. And this is pounded into hockey players' heads from almost the very beginning. Don't do anything to be a distraction to the team. Whether it's something ridiculous at a party, understand that, or whether it's become an activist for an issue. Like, I'm of the firm belief, Elliot, that one of the things that's kept people from coming out in the NHL is this idea of not becoming a distraction. Players grew up with this fear of being
that.
A distraction to their team, whether it's political awareness, mm-hmm. whether it's their sexuality. This idea of being a distraction does more harm to human beings in the game than a lot of other things.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a really hard time with that.
Yeah, I get that. I understand that. But I think there's truth to that. And also, I think the other thing now is social media. People can get to you faster. And it takes a really thick skin to deal with that. If you have a Twitter account, people don't just write letters to the editor anymore or write letters to your team that you don't see.
Yeah.
It comes right to you. And it's not easy sometimes to deal with that. You know, the thing that really hardened me was Rio. When I screwed up that race and I went through that meat grinder, it changed me, I think, for the better. I don't get bothered anymore. Like, when you go through that, if you can come out the other side, it's like, pfft, like, bring it on. Like, mm-hmm. there's very few things that upset me anymore. But I think the fear is going through that because it sucks. And I think whether your stance is courageous or not, whatever it is,
sure.
to go through that for the first time, it can scar you. And I've seen it happen to people. One of the things I do now is when I see people go through that, whether I know them or not, I'll send them a note and I'll tell them, you're going to get through this. Like Maverick Carter, who is one of LeBron James' friends and runs, has become a very successful businessman of his own. He talked about that at the Sloan Conference last week. Alex Rodriguez had a great comment where he says, I have a master's in failure and a PhD in getting back up.
Hmm.
And but the thing is, you don't know that until you go through it the first time. And it's hard. And I understand why some people don't put themselves out there for that reason.
Did you see what Colorado did this week on their broadcast? Colorado, Vancouver. Altitude Sports.
No, you know, I didn't watch that game that night.
Second period.
My brain was fried that night.
The art of play-by-play while the game was going on took a back seat to a conversation with Avs general manager Joe Sakic.
Is it a little cat and mouse? I mean, you say, do you call and say, hey, I like Smith, when really you like Jones, hoping he's going to say, well, what about Jones?
It's got to be fun. It's fun, and I got a great relationship with all of them. And everybody's pretty honest. There's none of that going on. You cut to the chase. What are you looking to do? What are you looking for? And just see if there's a match.
Has anyone ever said to you, you know what? I don't have that guy, but... The Rangers have a guy that you might be looking for like that.
Yeah, we kind of focus on each other unless you need the other team to get involved.
Which you had a three-way trade deal with Ottawa and Nashville. So when that happens, do you have to be on the phone at the same time? Or is that a case where Peter said, oh, wait a minute, you know what, we can make something happen, but let's get another team involved.
Well, yeah, I mean, both ways. I think when it gets that...
Okay, so that's one very unique way to present a period of hockey, almost where the game itself becomes secondary and that conversation is primary. And it's in some ways refreshing, and some people don't need... I mean, if you follow the game closely, you know all the numbers, you know all the plays, you know the positioning, the body, and you understand what's going on. For others, they need, you know, that staccato pace, and you need to know who the players are and where the puck is going and why that's happening. The reason I found it so intriguing is... I think you and I have talked about this before. Secondary streams for broadcasts are a thing that needs to happen in the NHL yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
For people that just want to have or be part of a conversation while the game is going on, and you can interject and, oh, that's a penalty, that's going to be two for high sticking. Oh, there's a goal there. It's Nathan MacKinnon's 22nd goal of the season, whatever. And I know NBC experimented with this a number of years ago, that while the game was going on, it was more of a conversation with the announcers and the game itself almost became secondary. They experimented with it for a while and then went away from it, and now they're back to doing a very traditional broadcast. But now given, and I know other sports do this, and it's wildly successful, where are we at with hockey?
We talked about this in our first broadcast.
Yeah.
It's going to come.
I heard in that Colorado broadcast, I'm like, yeah, this is what me and Friedge were talking about.
My only concern about it is that it'll put me out of a job. But
we always have to go back to, as someone who works in the studio, we always have to go back to studio for the intermission.
You know, I'll tell you, if you watch, I don't know how much of a basketball fan you are, but the NBA has their players-only broadcast out there. They're good.
Yeah.
You know, they are good. And it's going to happen eventually. You know, the biggest problem, I don't remember if we talked about this when we did this podcast. In the NHL, the star players, they don't want to do TV. They've made enough money, they want to disappear.
I know.
In the NBA and the NFL, they want to be on TV. And the other thing, too, is the money is much bigger in basketball and football than it is in hockey. So I think the combination of those two things is a factor. You know, I'll tell you, when Kevin Bieksa retires... He's going to walk into a TV studio somewhere. There are other guys, too. It's all going to depend
on... Chris Pronger could have.
Yeah,
Chris,
it's all going to depend
Chris,
on
Chris
what these
Pronger,
guys want to do.
With his editorial, yeah. his attitude, his style, his persona.
It's going to happen
Chris Pronger
someday.
Could have walked into any television studio and said, yeah, I'll take that position. Thank you very much. All right, let's finish up the podcast here. Thanks so much for joining us today, and thanks so much for tuning into our trade deadline coverage. On Sportsnet, we'll finish up with some hashtag Ask 31s. This comes to us from The Keith at Superpunk Canada. Are Edmonton Oilers fans expecting too much from Lucic?
No, I don't think you expect too much. Like, when you get paid a certain way, there's an expectation for you to deliver. And, you know, I think the toughest thing was in that game against San Jose, regardless of what you thought was a penalty, and I thought it was a penalty. I don't understand how Evander Kane wasn't
penalized. That's the hit from behind, yeah.
On Matt Benning. Like, to me, that was a penalty. But you're almost looking for some kind of reaction. Like, that's one of the things he's there for is when you're having a year like that, like, okay.
And with all due respect, you're not after the 2 points.
No. And you know what? But also, it's like, you know what? There's a limit to what we're going to – well, I was expecting as much out of frustration as anything else. Like, seriously, with the year we're having and we get that call and yeah. I don't know. If I was Vancouver and Edmonton, I would be talking about a Lucic for Erickson deal.
Two players struggling with those teams. There's an issue with terms.
Well, Erickson has one less year than Lucic, so Edmonton might have to sweeten it a little bit because Vancouver's taking more term. But I wonder if those two teams would consider something like that because both of those players need a change of scenery. I have no problem with Oilers fans having expectations.
This from Iceman. Do the teams or does the league ever consider going back to home teams wearing white?
I have to tell you, I get asked this question periodically. This is a bad question for me. Like, I don't think about uniforms at all. I'm like, do I like it? Do I not like it?
You know me with whites on TV.
I can understand why some people wouldn't like it. Like, we're going to see it on Saturday night, right?
The Maple Leafs are wearing a whole lot of white. Toronto and Washington.
Wearing all whites. And at the, by the way, I can't wait for this. I'm very excited.
You looking forward to this Washington-Toronto game?
Yeah, Naval Academy. I think that's very interesting.
Very cool. All right, from Patrick Luftquist. Another color. I'm getting a lot of color tweets this week. What would an interesting color scheme be for Seattle? To me, it's got to be green. And second of all, there's not enough green. I can't speak to other sports. Not enough green in hockey to begin with. And maybe it's just because I love that old St. Pat's combination of even just the green and brown. I love. Yes, I'm the guy that loved the brown
pants.
Well,
what's the millionaires? Remember what the Canucks wore?
I didn't cover the millionaires back in the day.
No, but they wore the millionaires' old uniforms. Do you want to do millionaires? Do you want to do totems? What do you want to do?
I like the totems. I love what the T-Birds do. I love that color scheme. To me, as long as there's a predominant color of green.
It's got
to
be green. It's green, and there's no arguing this.
All right. Thanks. Just a couple of quick tweets to conclude the broadcast. You mentioned the outdoor game coming up on Saturday. Want to thank everybody for watching our trade deadline coverage as well. You want to put a final bow on trade deadline versus tweak deadline. And the movement now is draft day is another trade deadline day. More so in a lot of ways than trade deadline day is itself. True or false, Elliot Friedman?
Draft is more important now. Draft is more important.
For making deals.
Yes. That's the time now.
Because everybody's available.
Everybody's got cap room. You get your 10% bump. Contracts come off. You got more flexibility. You really know about your team. You've seen, if you're in the playoffs, you've seen what your team has done.
And you can react emotionally because those wounds or the scars are still close to the skin.
Or you get a bit more time to really understand what you feel about your group.
How much is it? Is everybody's all in the same room?
That helps.
Right? I mean, we see this every
year.
Let's
make this deal over a beer.
Right? You see the hotel every year, right?
Frank
you walk
Mahalovich
in.
Being traded on a napkin. Let's do that.
You know, I'll tell you. I at the draft in, well, hang on, it would have been, what is it? Was it Buffalo? No, it would have been last year in Chicago. Walked in and I saw Rocky Thompson, who's now with the Chicago Wolves, talking to people from Vegas. And I said, oh, that's interesting. And everyone thought that Rocky Thompson was going to end up as the Vancouver Canucks. And then 2 weeks later, just announced as the head coach of the Chicago Wolves, AHL affiliate of the Vegas Golden Knights. There it is, Rocky Thompson. So a lot of these things do tend to happen when everybody gets together.
Absolutely.
And there's a million stories like that. And a million more stories that we will explore here on the podcast. But now that's it. We're done. We're out of words. Thanks to Emil Delich, our producer, making sound
great
as he does every week.
Who I called by the proper name all day today.
Dude, man, you were like 3 for 3 today. You were nailing it on the podcast. Thanks for listening to 31 Thoughts, the podcast. Back in 7 days.